The best estimates we have is that there are more than 400 million people defecating in the open, and another more than 500 million people have access to some type of facility, but that is really not appropriate.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Millions of people around the world have no access to sanitation. They defecate in the open or in facilities where it's hard to avoid contact with human waste, and this helps to spread disease. One of the Sustainable Development Goals that you don't hear about so much is the call to end open defecation by 2030. So what progress are we making and what health improvements are we seeing so far? In the latest of our episodes on JPAL's Policy Insights, I'm talking to Karen McCaw of the Paris School of Economics. She's also co-chair of JPAL's health sector, about how we can give access to sanitation and what that can achieve. Karen, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks for having me, Tim. It's great to be here.
Now, Karen, how many people at the moment are forced to defecate in the open?
We're starting with a great question because the UN, the WHO and the UNICEF just try to put data together about this. The best estimates we have is that there are more than 400 million people defecating in the open, and another more than 500 million people have access to some type of facility, but that is really not appropriate. So we're really talking about close to a billion people for whom this is a serious concern.
There's a huge number of people. What sort of disease spreads this way? How does it spread?
So there is two main channels. One is that without appropriate facilities, there is high risks of human contact with fishes and diseases spreading through that. The other way is that the fishes can contaminate water and through that it can spread. The contamination that would come then can lead to either infections through parasites, hookworm or roundworm, or also diarrheal diseases, cholera being one obvious one.
We know that there is an impact on children's development. What sort of effects are we talking about here? How do we measure it?
Those diseases and the diarrhea that comes with it will affect the nutritional status of children, so their food intake is lower. Now, food intake, both macro and micronutrients, is tremendously important, especially during the early years of life, for linear growth, so kind of how tall children become, but also for cognitive development, for brain cells connecting. So the potential health implications of children in particular, and of course humans more generally, can be substantial.
Now, I'm assuming that the places that we're talking about here do not have access to clean, piped water. In that case, what sort of facilities is it possible to provide?
This is a good way of framing the question because it's important to see what's the first best here. The first best is are the systems that we all know and that many of us may not think about twice, about taking them for granted. But so piped water, kind of a system of waste control, is clearly the first best. We still have many places in the world where those are not an option. But in most places, pit latrines are accessible one way or the other, or at least it's something that people know. And so when we talk about pit latrines, we're really talking about pit latrines that have a concrete slab that covers the pit, so in order to avoid the contact with the human waste.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit more about what the research has shown so far in a moment.
My name is Oliver Hanney. I'm the managing editor here at VoxDev, and I'm here to give our VoxDevlets a short plug. We now have 14 available on our website and the same amount currently underway. VoxDevlets from VoxDev are easy to read, policy-oriented literature reviews that will help you to stay informed. In each VoxDevlet, experts in their field distill the evidence on important questions in development economics.
What's interesting is that it is actually trying to do different things.
Every time we answer a question, it raises one or two more.
From agriculture to trade, from bureaucracy to mobile money, VoxDevlets are open access, accessibly written, policy-focused and regularly updated. Find them at voxdev.org/voxdevlet.
This is a really interesting set of questions. It opens up a whole can of worms.
And stay tuned for our upcoming release on electricity infrastructure and an update to our VoxDevlet on the informal sector.
Karen, is helping people to build toilets or to buy toilets expensive? I thought it might well be, both the subsidy that you might provide and the investment that you're expecting households to make.
Yeah, that's correct. So this is not a very kind of light touch type of intervention that one needs to solve this problem. The actual costs are going to depend a lot on the context because the access to materials, but also access to know-how, access to you refer to labor in order to take the pits, etc. All of those is going to differ, and of course the different materials that come with it. Now, we have learned quite a bit about this. So this is an area where we now have 26 randomized evaluations from 14 countries. All of those are either in Africa or in different parts of Asia. This has been, there's a big policy agenda in South Asia and India in particular. And so we have some sense of costs and also to what extent addressing those costs can be effective.
And so in that case, is it good policy to provide loans to households to enable them to build these facilities?
To address these kind of substantial costs, definitely substantial from the perspective for most poor and the poorest households, we see programs with two options. The most common ones are providing subsidies, and then indeed the alternative would be to provide loans. And so most of the evidence is actually on the subsidy part that helps cover the cost of materials and also typically comes together with some access to know-how about it.
And do we know that these policies work in, well, first of all, I guess, for helping people to build the facilities, but then also to increase the use of them as well?
Yeah, that's really the right way of thinking of this. There is a first step of increasing the access, yeah. But then once we've increased the access, are people using them? Do they continue to use them? And then down the theory of changes is lead to outcomes. So what we do know is that when we provide subsidies, at least all the studies that have looked at this carefully, they all have a clear answer in the same direction. With subsidies, the access to toilets increases. With loans, that's mostly also true. It's a little bit more mixed. And in particular, there is actually some results in the literature that even when people take up loans, the kind of construction sometimes doesn't get completed.
Right.
But there is also just much less evidence on the loans part, I should say. And to a certain extent, that's quite intuitive because what we're trying to address here is a health externality. There is part of the benefit that comes from improved sanitation is not going to benefit the individual that makes the investment. It is the household at large, but also the community at large. And so given that we're talking about contamination of groundwater, etc., that's a type of market imperfection for which we expect subsidies to make a difference, but to overcome the fact that the benefits of this will not just come to the person investing.
And that behavior change element, do we know that this goes sort of one-to-one with the construction of the facilities?
So there's two pieces to this. So in the other types of interventions that we see, apart from interventions trying to address the liquidity constraints, the costs of the toilets, is indeed interventions trying to provide information and awareness more broadly about the way that not using the relevant sanitation facilities can lead to wealth and to environmental concerns. So some of these awareness campaigns go through quite some length to help people understand these causal chains that otherwise they're not visible for people. It's not something that you would know if nobody explains you in the same way that we started this podcast explaining this issue. So a number of interventions are focused on that. Some interventions also do both. They will provide and the subsidies and some type of awareness or community. And so often it's at the community level, community awareness campaigns. On those community awareness campaigns or information campaigns more general, the evidence is a little bit more mixed, but overall, most of the evidence does point to positive impacts on, again, the use of the access to and then the use of latrines. Sometimes the impacts are not very large, and also some of the impacts don't sustain very long. And so there's a bit of a question on how do we design those type of programs to be intensive enough. And so we see, for instance, that interventions, including these evaluations that test a couple of different ways of doing this, where the more intensive interventions with more follow-up, and so that are also, as a result, more costly, will lead to larger behavioral change.
These community-led sanitation programs, what exactly is happening in this case? They sometimes replace, they sometimes complement the construction of facilities. What are people being told? What is the education element?
So indeed, there is an approach that is called the Community-Led Total Sanitation, CLTS. And that particular approach has been scaled and tested in many different settings, sometimes in combination with subsidies for latrine construction, sometimes on its own. What typically happens in these campaigns is a facilitator walking with the community, getting community members together, walking through the village, pointing out where fecal contamination may be happening and how that may be then be affecting food, but also drinking water, and what are the potential interventions and areas to help reduce these contaminations from happening.
Now, also these toilets, these facilities, they do have to be maintained, kept clean. How do we do that? Can subsidies help there?
Again, we have less evidence on this, but we have some evidence. This is also an issue that relevance of this depends on the context.
Mm-hmm.
But so if you're in a rural area, then once the latrine is full, the advice is to build a new latrine rather than to try to recuperate the old latrine, which would be really hard. Now, in urban areas, of course, you can't just move things around that easily. And so indeed, we have evidence from urban Senegal in particular, where there were subsidies provided to help the maintenance and indeed the emptying in a more sanitary way and showing that that indeed had impacts down the line on outcomes, on both use and then subsequently on other outcomes.
Interventions like this, sometimes you get those spillover effects for people who aren't in the treatment group. So if some households in a community are changing their practices, building toilets, do you get these spillover effects in this case?
So this is an area where the spillovers are actually quite complicated because they can go in both directions, theoretically at least. And then the question is, how does it pan out in a given context? But theoretically, it is indeed possible that if a household builds a latrine, another members from a different household can use that latrine. So that's potentially a positive spillover effect. It is also possible, however, that people understand externalities and they may say, well, if my neighbors are not building latrines, there is no point for me to do so because the contamination will keep on happening.
Ah.
And there may even be people who say, well, if almost everybody built latrines, then no, really, there is no point for me to do it anymore. And so this is just one example. Of course, there is also the classical social interactions to peer pressures, right? So the through those awareness campaigns, typically the effort is, you know, through the awareness raising. There could be now that people are also becoming more aware and in a certain way are monitoring each other about the latrine use. So the interactions here, the spillovers can really go many different ways, which is also why this is one of the areas that the research has focused on.
So we started this conversation talking about the impacts on health and the serious impacts that there could be on health, especially for children. Do we have a measurement of the good impacts of successful policy here? Is it making a positive impact on health?
So this is a great question because this is actually not as simple as it would seem like.
Right.
In a certain way, the biology of the problem seems relatively straightforward. When we are looking at the results of the field experiments that have been successful at increasing toilet use, at reducing open defecation, we don't always find impacts on health, even for studies that were designed to look carefully at the impacts on health. Now, there is a couple of different ways of thinking of that. So let me give a bit more detail. So first of all, a lot of studies ask for impact on diarrhea, which is sort of mm-hmm. a symptom of less infections. Of course, diarrhea is a self-reported outcome in most cases. And so there is some kind of measurement concerns with that, because once you have awareness campaigns that make people notice more general questions around contamination, but also know that this may lead to diarrhea or not, they may overrun the report, translating the awareness into what they're answering. Because it's self-reported, we were concerned with biases. So many of the studies on diarrhea rates that are self-reported don't find impacts on self-reported diarrhea. More clear in a certain way in terms of final outcome is studies that look at children's linear growth, so height for mm-hmm. age, or to what extent do we get an indication of better nutritional status. And there is only a minority of studies finding impacts, including some that are very convincingly showing, but most studies don't find impacts on nutritional status, including some studies by economists and epidemiologists and public health people together, specifically designed to look at these type of questions. And so that may seem disappointing to a certain yeah. extent. It clearly points to the need to do more research on this to understand this better. I think for some listeners, this may not be a complete surprise because we also know that nutritional status of children is going to be affected by many, many different factors, not only sanitation. Obviously, it partly also depends on macronutrient intake. Health conditions don't only depend on sanitation and definitely not just on latrines. They also depend on both other wash behaviors, but also to what extent the environment is more or less healthy, to what extent the children are otherwise stronger and can fight infections, to what extent they're humanized, yeah, they've had vaccinations. There's a lot of other things that is going to affect nutritional status of children. One way of reading the sets of results is to say, well, improving access to improved latrines alone is not making a difference. It's less clear to what extent that access, together with addressing many of these other factors too, would make a bigger difference. The few studies that have looked to try at those interactions don't necessarily point to strong complementarities, but there's definitely much more work to be done here.
I would have thought one of the impacts of not being able to demonstrate a clear health effect, accepting all that those problems and the difficulties in doing so would be that maybe this would fall down the list of policy priorities? Is there evidence that this, as you say, not a light touch intervention, gets deprioritized as a result?
As far as I can tell, the deprioritization per se hasn't really happened. I think more the both the policymakers and the researchers are in line with the idea that we need to understand this better. Exactly in a certain way, because the biological foundation for this problem is clear.
Yes.
There is a reason we're concerned about this. And we also understand, as economists, the market imperfection, in particular the externalities that are involved here, as to why households and communities making decisions on their own may not come to the optimal outcome. Now, there is another part of this puzzle, and again, the researchers push on that, which goes back to the externalities. Another potential reason as to why we don't see health results in some of these studies is because we may not have reached a high enough rate of toilet use or improved toilet use. And so indeed, most of the studies, they find positive, significant impact, but in all cases, it's far from universal coverage, let's say in communities, of the use of these improved latrines. So that means that the contamination continues to happen to a certain extent and possibly still too much. So that's a plausible explanation. There is some non-experimental results that do suggest that when you have higher rates of coverage, you may have stronger results also on the health outcomes. But that's still very much at the research phase of things and something that where we need more research. There is a good biological reason in a certain way to believe that this could be part of the explanation. We need more results. And so going back to your question on what does that mean for policy, as far as I am aware, it's not that there has been a disinvestment in sanitation or more general in much. No, I do think what it does mean is that going back to what we started with, which is the first best. So given that this is a hard problem to even get the second best right, for policymakers, I think that does mean is to think about, well, maybe there are contexts where we really should be thinking again about pipe sanitation systems in urban areas or where it may not have seemed feasible or may not be on the agenda, given that the alternative is clearly not the best solution. In some cases, putting the policy focus back on, in a certain way, the first best solution would be a potential good outcome of this research.
So given, as you say, the need for coverage, the need for both facilities and behaviour change, and the complementarity of other interventions, if we wrapped this in, ideally, to a community health campaign, then we might get stronger results.
It could be. As I said, the few results, the few studies that have tried to look at those complementarities don't find strong evidence of that. And so this is still very much open for more research.
Clearly something that's very important and an area where there's clearly still a lot to do. Karen, thank you very much for talking about it.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me.
If you want to look at this research, it is Improving Sanitation with Subsidies, Loans and Community-Led Programs. As always, if you want to find that, go to www.povertyactionlab.org. Search for it there. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes are at voxdev.org, where you will find articles about the topics that we feature. And remember, if you like what you're hearing, tell someone else about us. Leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hani and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.